Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Mara Liasson, filling in for Ron Elving.
And I wish the listener could have just heard the conversation we just had for the last 15 minutes. A lot of people don't know this. Mara Liasson is hysterically funny. People don't know this.
And you know what people don't know? You are not.
Well, no, they know that. And this podcast will prove it. And the news of the week, well, first of all, I should announce for the listener that this podcast, because of logistical reasons, we're doing this on Wednesday morning, an hour and a half before the president holds a press conference. But since we know what's going to happen anyway, we will talk about it as if...
Ken will play the role of the president and tell us what he's going to say.
Well, I'm evolving. I think I'm evolving out the door is what I'm evolving. But the big political news of the week, and we'll get to the 2012 stuff in a bit, but I was fascinated by what happened in New York with the passage of same-sex marriage, now one of only six states that has that law. And the other states are basically, you know, the small states in New England and Iowa. But New York's a big state. And Mara, what's your reaction? And what do you think is the big consequence of what happened there?
Well, I think the big consequence of what happens there is gay marriage becomes more mainstream. New York is a big state. Like you said, it's not Vermont. But the other thing that it does do, perhaps, is make the divide in this country around gay marriage a little bit starker, because every state that's put gay marriage on the ballot, right, it has lost.
Right. There are 29. There are 29 states that have constitutional amendments barring it. Another 12 states that have laws prohibiting it. So we're only talking about six states here.
Right. And the anti-gay marriage forces believe that it is a winner for them. Anytime it's on the ballot, it wins. The anti-gay marriage
Every
proposal
time.
Wins, and it brings out conservative voters.
Right. What fascinated me most about this was not only did the Republican majority, New York State Senate, let it come up for a vote, but it also passed it as well, and it just showed some indication that there may be some giving and taking between the two parties on issues like this.
Right. And it also shows one thing that conservatives have always said about issues like this is they shouldn't be decided by unelected judges. They should be decided by either the people in a referendum or their representatives in the state legislature. And that's what happened here. And I think that is the way to pass big pieces of social legislation so you do get a consensus.
But as you say, when it goes to the ballots, it gets defeated every time. And we saw when the courts in Iowa instituted gay marriage, the three of the members of the Supreme Court were recalled by the voters.
Yes, that's the more likely scenario. If the court imposes something and it doesn't reflect the will of the people, well, it's going to get overturned. But in this case, state legislators have to stand for re-election, and they more accurately, in theory at least, represent the will of the people.
Now, we are taking a risk by talking about what President Obama's positions may or may not be, how it may or may not be evolving. And we understand it is evolving. During the 2008 campaign, he said he's for marriages between a man and a woman, and he said that's part of his Christian philosophy and things like that, although he has conceded that things are evolving. But for the gay community looking for President Obama for leadership, they're not finding it.
No, I have to assume that evolving means he's getting towards a position of supporting gay marriage, and he will get there at some point. The administration decided not to defend DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, in the courts. So there have been little movements.
And don't ask, don't
tell. And of course, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they overturned. But yes, I think that evolving is kind of code, which is I'm getting there eventually. He has to figure out the politics of this before he goes all the way.
Now, before everybody says, boy, the Republicans in the state legislature in New York passed this historic bill, which they did, on the 2012 campaign trail, we're talking about the Republican field now, I don't see any differences among the candidates on gay marriage, although, of course, John Huntsman does support civil unions.
Not only is there no difference, the big news this week in the Republican primary fight was that Michelle Bachmann, who cut her teeth in Minnesota opposing gay marriage, announced. Not only did she announce, she got a huge boost when the Des Moines Register poll, the first poll of the Republican primary season, put her in a statistical tie with Mitt Romney in Iowa. It is her home state. She was born there. She has a big base of support there. She turned in a pretty good performance in the first New Hampshire Republican debate last week.
Yep.
And she has been really riding a wave. I would say right now, I spent some time with her in New Hampshire yesterday. She is the conservative woman of the moment. And until Rick Perry gets into the race or something
then
changes,
then he'll be the Republican woman of the moment.
Right. Until the lineup changes, she is the number one alternative to Mitt Romney. There is nobody else that can credibly claim that spot right now.
Isn't it funny the way we do this? Because I remember not too long ago, Tim Pawlenty was the alternative to Mitt Romney.
He wanted to be. He was. There are many mini primaries in a primary season. Right. There's the money primary, and we're going to hear about that later this week when they all put in their fundraising reports. There's the pundit primary to see who can capture the imaginations
straw
of
polls.
People like you and me. There's straw polls. But there has been this internal intramural primary for who will emerge as the alternative to the front runner.
Wait, do you remember once upon a time we used to say that about Hillary Clinton?
Yes.
Remember the New York Times magazine with a picture of Mark Warner on the cover, the anti-Hillary, as if he was the alternative to Hillary Clinton. They did that, and of course Hillary Clinton was not the nominee.
Right. And neither was Mark Warner. There has been this intramural fight to see who would emerge as the alternative to Romney. And I would say at this moment in time, Michelle Bachmann is it. For people who feel that Romney either flip-flops too much or he's not conservative enough, she offers a kind of steel-clad Republican package.
True
she
believer.
Is a true believer. She's a conviction politician. She comes out of the Christian conservative activist movement. She is.
By the way, Rod Blagojevich is also a conviction politician. We'll talk about him later. Okay, I'm sorry. Was that funny? Wait, Mara, was that funny for you? Mara?
Not really.
Okay.
Anyway, Michelle Bachmann is presenting herself as someone who covers all the bases in conservative Republican politics.
Economic, she's social.
Social conservative, economic conservative, foreign policy conservative. She thinks that President Obama is pulling out of Afghanistan too fast. And she's also very poised, very polished on the stump. People don't just like her, they adore her. And I don't know if she can go all the way. She's trying to do something that's never been done before. Number one, be a woman who gets the Republican nomination. And number two, be the first sitting member of the House of Representatives since 1880.
Who was
that? James Garfield.
And you know what happened to him?
But she's been doing very well. She surged in New Hampshire. She was very low single digits. The latest poll shows that she's come up, I think, about 8 or 11 points. Mitt
right.
Romney is still, you know, double digit.
You know,
leader.
We are talking about June of 2011.
Yes,
and
we
are. Also know that in the first Des Moines Register poll in 2007, at this time, John Edwards was the leader on the Democratic
Absolutely.
Side.
Absolutely. Okay, this is a snapshot in time.
Right.
But at this moment, which is all we have to judge,
right.
She is having her moment, and we'll see if she can go the distance. The big challenge for her is, can she do better than Mike Huckabee? Mike Huckabee captured the evangelical base in Iowa. He was also a very polished populist campaigner, very, very compelling on the stump, but he didn't have any steam after his Iowa caucus victory.
He also didn't have any money.
He didn't have any money. He surged late in Iowa, so he wasn't able to raise the money. Michelle Bachmann comes into the race being the number one fundraiser in the House of Representatives. Last year, she raised $13.5 million, more than any other congressman. So she has the money. Now we have to see if she can raise presidential campaign level money. We also have to see if she can set up an organization drawing on the Tea Party in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Florida, not just Iowa.
I agree. The momentum seems to be with her.
At
clearly,
the moment.
Two names I want to throw out there, and I want to talk about both Rick Perry and Sarah Palin. Let's start with Rick Perry.
Rick Perry seems to be getting ready to get in. Every Republican I talk to would bet that he will.
Really?
But what his advisors say, and they're very honest about this, they're saying, we're seeing if it's possible at this late date to get in. I think Rick Perry clearly sees there's room for him. There's no Southern governor in the race. He believes
Texas.
No top tier Southerner in the
race,
right? No Southern governor. He occupies the same political space as Michelle Bachmann, Tea Party hero, small government conservative, evangelical. But he has to see, can he raise the money quickly? Are there enough donors who aren't committed to other candidates? And of course, he has a huge, very deep fundraising bench to draw from in Texas.
Yes, but in large numbers, you still have to give $2,500 per person.
Yes, that's what he's trying to determine. It is late.
Is it late, though?
Here's what I think about it being late. Some people think he can get in August. It's not too late to get into South Carolina, for instance. I think all you have to do is pay the filing fee and meet the constitutional requirements.
That is correct.
But I think there are 7 or 8 states where it's a little more complicated to get on the primary ballot. And I think after July 15th, I don't know if you can. I mean, I think
6 months in advance?
I mean, I think so. The point is he has to get going. If he wants to compete in every single primary, some of the Republicans I've talked to have said after the middle of July, it just gets harder and harder, just technically.
You know, we love trivia on this program. I like to call it a program. It's my personal program. But here's a trivia question.
A travesty is what some other people call it.
I think most people call it that. But who was the last Texas governor elected president?
Now, that's funny.
Speaking of funny.
And that is actually, you raise an important point, though. Because
me?
Even you can raise an important point occasionally.
Thank you, Mark.
You raise an important point because once Rick Perry gets in, there's the honeymoon period. And, of course, he'll be, just like every other candidate has had their moment in the sun. Right. Romney had a great rollout. Michelle Bachmann's having a fabulous rollout. John Huntsman had a great rollout. Very short, but maybe the first 5 minutes were a great rollout.
Until they got his name wrong in the bus I went to Saudi Arabia.
But anyway, Rick Perry is going to remind a lot of people of George W. Bush.
Yeah, I don't see
and
it.
That's,
but...
No, he is different than George W. Bush.
They don't even like each other, by the way.
Yes, but to people who don't pay terribly close attention to this, he's another Texas governor. Yeah, yeah. Didn't we just have one?
Right, that's true. I mean, if you remember the 2010 gubernatorial primary, most of the Bush people, in fact, almost all the Bush people, backed Kay Bailey Hutchison over Rick Perry. So there is not great blood, but it's true. You say a Texas governor, you think of George W. Bush, you think of Rick Perry. Right?
But one of the other things that I think Rick Perry is counting on, and one of the reasons he is so drawn to the idea of running, is that Texas has a very good economic story to tell. And the more these other candidates dropped out of the race or decided not to run, Haley Barbour, Mitch Daniels, he sees a real spot for himself as an alternative to Romney because I think almost one third of the jobs that have been created since the recession began have been created in Texas. So he has a story to tell.
We keep talking about Mitt Romney as, you know, as everybody's the alternative to Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's not doing that badly. I mean,
he's doing great. He is the front runner.
You
have to say that at this moment in time, he's the front runner because he's ahead of all the polls and in nationally. And he's going to have the most money on Friday, a tremendous fundraising number we are told to expect. And nobody has emerged yet as a heavyweight alternative to him. People are now auditioning for the spot. Michelle Bachmann is getting her chance now, and maybe Rick Perry will get in and see what he can do. But the reason why there is this space for an alternative to Mitt Romney is because a lot of Republicans think there should be. They're not thrilled with him. They don't like Romney Care, the Massachusetts health care plan. They feel he's flip-flopped too much on a whole host of
issues.
And they're not sure, especially abortion,
which has come up more and more candidates are insisting that he sign the pledge.
Which he is refusing.
So
are others. But I think that there are people who want an alternative to Mitt Romney. They don't think he's the best candidate.
You could make the case, though, that if Rick Perry gets in, and Michelle Bachmann, and Tim Pawlenty. There are so many
alternatives. Yes, they all split the conservative vote.
Right,
the Tea Party vote, the anti-Romney vote. And some of it is going to be, and then the Tea Party goes in a million different directions instead of coalescing behind one candidate, which will not be Mitt Romney.
No, right. The other person we talked about in the news this week is Sarah Palin. She did her tour. She went to Iowa this week, a day after Michelle Bachmann, coincidentally, maybe not, but it was...
And the same day as President Obama was there, too.
For his non-political rally. But the thing is that there was a screening of her movie, The Undefeated. Mara Lyson, explain to me what Undefeated means.
This is a movie about her.
Right.
It was made...
About her 15 minutes as governor of Alaska.
Yes, this is a movie that is extremely positive. It's a movie that some people think will resurrect her reputation, you know, refurbish her reputation. And she didn't necessarily cooperate, although bits of her own voice are in the movie reading her book.
She clearly gave it approval.
Yes. But she wasn't interviewed for the movie. So it's a documentary-style movie, and it will be shown various places around the country.
Key states like New Hampshire, South Carolina. Right?
And the thing about Sarah Palin is Sarah Palin has been doing this dance about whether or not she's going to get in. There are a lot of people who think she should. But the clock is ticking. And what we've seen as the clock is ticking and as she has done absolutely nothing to get ready for a run, and it should be said that she has to do less preparation than other candidates because she has 100% name recognition and an incredibly fervent following. Well, in the Republican Party, for better, I think, and a very fervent following. But the clock is ticking, and the longer she goes without doing anything, the more people are going to sign up with other candidates. And now Michelle Bachmann is proving herself to be very serious, very polished, very poised, very exciting and electrifying on the stump.
Not to compare, I mean, the tendency and the laziness, perhaps, is to compare Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin. But you spent time with Michelle Bachmann this week. Have you ever spent time with Sarah Palin? I just can't see Sarah Palin giving you or anyone the kind of access that Michelle Bachmann seems to give the media.
Michelle Bachmann, I think it is unfair to compare them. They are two conservative, firebrand women with devoted followings. They're very attractive, very articulate. However, Michelle Bachmann does not participate in the politics of grievance. And she doesn't seem to have a grudge against the media. She doesn't seem to portray herself as a victim, even though I think she's been treated unfairly, as women are in politics, you know, on occasion. But I think that she has a more serious, more thoughtful approach to some issues. She's clearly spent more time thinking about foreign policy. She can explain her views, I think, more coherently and articulately than Sarah Palin often could in the last campaign. The same thing with economic policy.
One other difference I notice is that Michelle Bachmann seems to reach out to more established political figures to help run her campaign. I don't know if Ed Rollins will be a plus or a minus, but I don't know, one major name, this could be a good thing or a bad thing, one major name who Sarah Palin is talking to.
Well, that's the point. Sarah Palin isn't doing anything right that we can see to lay the groundwork for a presidential run. She's had 2 years since the 2008 campaign to do all the things someone would do who was serious about building on the incredible following she developed in the Republican Party from her last campaign when she was the vice presidential candidate. She could have hired a whole group of mentors in different, like the Vulcans, like George W. Bush had people tutoring him on foreign policy and economics. She could have had political operatives around him who were experienced in running a national campaign, and she hasn't done that. That's why I have to come to the conclusion, at least now, that she isn't going to run. Unless she thinks she can run a completely different campaign where the traditional rules don't apply to her and she can do it all by Twitter.
If she does run, I've never seen a campaign in my lifetime, and that, you know, that goes back a bit.
Until 1775.
That I've never seen somebody who thinks she could do it just on name brand and the people.
I think she knows she can't. And that might be one of the reasons that she won't.
We haven't talked much about President Obama. He was in Iowa giving an economic speech. What do you make of what's going on in Libya? And how do you read the House vote last week on Libya, the kind of mixed message they gave? Yeah, we don't authorize it, but we're not cutting off the funds.
I think this is pretty typical congressional behavior. The War Powers Act is always championed by the party doesn't have the White House.
Absolutely.
When there's a Republican president and a Democratic Congress, Democrats like the War Powers Act. When Republicans find themselves in the majority in Congress, in the House, but not in the White House, all of a sudden they have a new respect for the War Powers Act, which some of them, including John Boehner, once suggested was unconstitutional. And I think his words were, it ties the hands of the commander-in-chief. But now he's...
Well, I'm sure President Obama was talking...
Barack Obama certainly liked the
George
War Powers
W.
Act,
right.
No doubt about
it.
So it's the ultimate partisan kind of hypocrisy. That being said, Libya is controversial. There are people who think that there's no U.S. national interest there. The White House has also been, I think, less than crystal clear about its position. It said that it doesn't want to comment on whether it thinks the War Powers Act is constitutional or not. Most presidents have thought it was not. But the War Powers Act anyway doesn't apply to the Libya situation because there are no, quote, hostilities there.
Right.
Now, it seems pretty hostile when you're part of a NATO operation. So I think they're being
dropping
a little too
clever.
Gaddafi's compound.
Yeah, right.
So I think they're being a little too clever by half. They need to explain themselves on this. But if Congress had the courage of its convictions and didn't want the U.S. to be involved in Libya, it doesn't even need the War Powers Act, it could exercise the power that everyone knows it has and there's no constitutional question about, which is the power of the purse. And it could cut off funding for the war, and it never does, and it won't.
We saw last week at the Netroots convention that the Obama administration representatives there got booed. I mean, the left is obviously uneasy about Libya. They're not satisfied with the same-sex marriage. Where does it go beyond complaints at a Netroots convention?
I don't think it goes anywhere because Obama is not going to face a primary challenge. The base of the Democratic Party has complained a lot about their president because he hasn't given them everything that they hoped he would.
And a lot of what he promised.
I do think that becoming a mature governing majority party means keeping your differences kind of inside the family. But the left has never been shy or hesitant about complaining about this president and pressuring him. And I think that's what you saw at the Netroots convention. They don't like what he's doing in Afghanistan, not getting out fast enough. They don't like the intervention in Libya.
Guantanamo,
prisoners' Guantanamo, rights, gay marriage, all sorts of things. But the fact is that the president is not facing a revolt from his left or from his base.
Certainly not with a primary challenge.
Right. And that would be the evidence of it. There's no primary challenge. The big question for him is, will progressives be so disillusioned that they'll stay home and they won't come out and organize for him?
That, I think, is what George H.W. Bush faced in 1992. Yes, Pat Buchanan ran against him. Yes, Ross Perot mounted a third-party challenge to him. But there are a lot of Republicans who were just dissatisfied with the previous 4 years, and a lot of them sat home.
And the big thing for them back then was that he broke his no new taxes right. pledge. And that brings us to the deficit talks, because the president can only go so far in compromising with the Republicans on the budget before he does cause his base to throw up their hands.
Okay, one thing about the debt ceiling, I mean, some Republicans are now insisting that the August 2nd deadline is artificial.
Well, you know, it's really interesting about that. Mitch McConnell in the Senate has always said, well, why don't we just pass little debt ceiling increases and just get the amount of deficit reduction that would get us another 6 months, and we can vote on this again and again and again. But you know what? The House Republican leadership does not want that. This is a terrible vote for them. Their members do not want to vote to raise the debt ceiling. They can't. A lot of these Tea Party freshmen campaigned that they would never raise the debt ceiling. This is not, by the way, to allow the government to borrow more in the future. This is to raise the debt ceiling so we can pay the debts we've already accumulated. But in any event, the debt ceiling is a terrible vote, very unpopular. The American people, by big majorities, say don't raise the debt ceiling. What they really mean is don't borrow any more money. But the Republican leadership in the House wants to get this over with. They want to get as good a deal as they can, but they only want to do this one time.
But you did see Eric Cantor walk out of the talks. Was that
yes.
Was that a big deal? Was that just a posturing move?
I think that was a big deal. Everybody expected that at some point the bipartisan negotiations that were being led by Vice President Joe Biden, that included Majority Leader Cantor and John Kyle, who's the Senate Republican whip, eventually they would come to the end of their work and they'd kick the negotiations upstairs, and John Boehner and Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell and President Obama would have to make the final deal. We didn't expect it would come so soon. Eric Cantor left the talks sooner than people expected. But when it comes to the really tough stuff, if the Republicans are going to compromise on taxes, and of course they say they don't want to, and we're talking now about tax loopholes, not raising people's right. rates, but getting rid of tax breaks for big corporations or rich individuals, if that was going to happen on the Republican side, and if the Democrats were going to compromise on entitlements like Medicare and Medicaid, which is very difficult for them, those kinds of decisions have to be made at the very top. Eric Cantor was not going to fall on his sword. He wants John Boehner to make those tough decisions and then have to sell it to his own Republican conference. And in the House, to pass any kind of a debt ceiling deal, the Republicans are going to need a lot of Democratic votes. Remember, they lost 59 Republicans in the last vote on the continuing resolution just to fund the government for the rest of this year. They had to get 81 Democrats to help them pass that. They're going to need even more, I think, this time, because the debt ceiling is even more unpopular. That means that they're going to have to make a deal that at least Democrats can vote for, at least enough Democrats can vote for. There's a consensus, by the way, that there should be the kind of tax reform that lowers rates across the board while getting rid of deductions, loopholes, what's called tax expenditures. But that is a huge, complicated process that the last time we did it took several years.
Amara, we're about to end this podcast, but I know we just can't leave without you commenting on one of your favorite people in the world, Rod Blagojevich, convicted 17 on 20 out of 20 counts.
Well, it sounds like he's going to go to prison
for a fair amount of time. Which is so rare for an Illinois governor.
Yeah. Yes, I think there is an Illinois governor's wing, isn't there, in the state penitentiary?
And after two wings, I hang up.
Oh.
Yeah, thank you.
But that does remind me of an actual real joke.
Okay. I'll let you know what's funny.
The joke about Edwin Edwards.
Right.
The inmate sidles up to him in the chow line.
Edwin Edwards is a former governor of Louisiana.
Louisiana, who went to prison. They're standing there in the chow line in the state penitentiary, and the inmate says to Edwin Edwards, "Food was a lot better here when you were the governor."
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm K.E.N. Rudin.
And I'm M.A.R.A. Liason.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Breaking rocks in a hot sun, I'm all below.